Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear parts of a fine and funny talk Jonathan Zittrain gave on the future of the Internet. He spoke at the University of Hartford on October 20. Zittrain is professor of law at Harvard Law School and an expert on Internet law. If you could imagine Robin Williams as a law professor, he'd sound like this. Zittrain identified four institutions relevant to digital communications. He drew a chart, and if you remember your algebra, you'd recognize it as a Cartesian coordinate system with four quadrants. Let's not go there over the radio. The first institution is government, with top-down control and a very hierarchical attitude. The second is consumer corporations, also with top-down control, but an attitude more attuned to the desires of the people, whom they call the customers. The third institution is radical individualism, and here we find the Internet. The Internet is controlled from the bottom up, so far, and is very attuned to the wishes of the people. The fourth institution is the community of online users. Control is bottom up, but instead of radical individualism, there is cooperation and the drive to consensus. An example is Wikipedia. Zittrain notes that the Internet has flourished because of its bottom-up and individualistic orientation. If you want a website that will support people from Portugal with bulimia, well, go and make one. You don't need anybody's permission. The problem is that, because it is decentralized and anonymous, the Internet is at tremendous risk of being intentionally damaged by all sorts of parties. The damage ranges from a virus let loose by some teenage misfit to cyber warfare conducted by nation-states. The two top-down institutions, government and corporations, each are saying, "I'll fix it. Just put me in charge of the digital communications system. I'll monitor everything, control content, control access, and flip the switch as soon as a problem is detected." To Zittrain, this would be a disaster for the people. He urges, instead, a change to the fourth option, control of the Internet by the community of its users. And he gives some examples of this working marvelously, such as the time Pakistan kidnapped YouTube. I'll play selections from Jonathan Zittrain's long and witty speech. Zittrain starts with the oddball history and philosophy of the Internet.
Now, the Internet came about from a kind of unlikely and significantly more goofy source. So these are three of the founders of the Internet, John Postel and Dave Crocker and Vint Cerf. They were classmates together at the same high school in suburban Los Angeles. So it's like we have a French club or a debate club. They were like, "Let's build a global network club." And it like worked really well. And here they are later for their 25th anniversary retrospective picture in Newsweek, which of course took hours to stage. And the first thing that jumps out is, these are a bunch of goofballs. And it's like, yes, that's important to the Internet ethos. Here they are, and they're basically showing with this a couple things. One is you can build a network out of just about anything. And even if you don't have a lot of money to invest, it's not like they had a big pile of capital, build me a network. Instead, what they do is they build it one node at a time. And any node can join the existing network at any other node point. And that kind of piggybacking, which you might be familiar with as like stealing cable from back in the day. This is the whole, the architecture is a stealing of cable architecture for the Internet. People should hook in with somebody who's already hooked in, and that'll be that. So they didn't have a lot of money to invest. That led to that architecture, and they weren't out to make any money, which is kind of extremely curious. But if you're not out to make any money, you can build a very different network. If you want to make money, for instance, you need to know who's connected to the network and what they're doing, so you can send them a bill and kick them off if they don't pay. Here, if you actually don't care to make any money, what do you care who's on the Internet? So they didn't put in any architecture to identify who's on the Internet because they didn't need to send them a bill. What a weird architectural huge choice flowing from an economic aspiration among these people not to get wildly rich out of what they were doing. So more formally, The kind of architecture they built that ended up blowing CompuServe out of the water is this so-called hourglass architecture. Broad at the top because it's designed for anybody to write any application and not have to consult with the internet engineers. The internet engineers worry about internet protocol. That is not intellectual property. It's internet protocol in the middle. And as long as that is functioning from one machine to another, you can do with it whatever you want. We presume you'll find something interesting to do, which is also why the internet has no main menu, which is very puzzling. You hook into the internet, it's just like, all right, connect to somebody. What do you want from us? We're the internet. And by not offering you anything, the internet came to offer you everything, because anybody could set up shop on the internet and do it. So very, very puzzling how it works. The way that packets go from one end to the other, instead of it being like a FedEx model where we hire someone to bring this object to the back of the room, and if they lose it, we know whom to blame, it's like, we are the change we've been waiting for. I can give you the laser pointer, and you'll give it to him, and he'll give it to her, and it'll eventually find its way back to the room, kind of like crowd surfing at a nice concert. And if it doesn't get there, oh well, we'll call it best efforts networking, also called send it and pray, or every packet an adventure. If it doesn't get there, send another one. Like, really different way of thinking about the network, so different that there's really curiosity about whether it could possibly work. As late as 1992, IBM was like, you could not possibly build a corporate network using this bizarre protocol. And that's why the founders of the internet say that their mascot, if they had one, would be the bumblebee, because the fur to wingspan ratio of the bumblebee is far too large for it to fly. And yet, somehow, mysteriously, the bee flies. It turns out just 4 years ago, they finally figured out how bees fly. It took like, you know, millions of dollars of government grants, more than was invested in the internet. And it turns out they flap their wings really quickly. So, who knew? So it's this architecture that meant no gatekeepers. Anybody could put up anything, and it's either popular or it's not. So like the first application of video over the web of any notoriety, the wheel of Gloucester cheese in Somerset, England, that you could watch ripen. It's still there. People tune in, and like it's very calming. They just watch the cheese ripen. It's like, I don't care how bad things are, if the cheese is still there, the world is okay. Or, I don't know, this site, cats that look like Hitler. So it's like, if you have a cat and it looks like Hitler, please submit its photo. And it turns out there are a number of cats that look like Hitler. It's like, who knew? Now, they didn't have to vie with anything on the internet's main menu. And it ended remarkably successful. It's like, do you want to come home to that cat every day? Like, holy crap. So, but not just the trivial stuff. It then starts to bring in, with amazing gravity, all of these other services start to yield to new services that start to occupy the space that remarkably don't come from incumbents. Like even eBay, right? Christie's or Sotheby's could have done auctions, but they didn't see it coming. So eBay ends up getting it. Now, what ends up happening? This is a snapshot, depending on whether you have a PC or a Mac, of all the junk running on your machine. You have no idea what any of this stuff does. The nerdiest person in this room cannot honestly tell me what this stuff does. Any one of these pieces of software could have a single line in it, delete the hard drive. That's it. Hard drive gets deleted. Now, you point this out, people are like, but yeah, who would do that? You're like, you're right, who would do that? It's a silly thought. Let's go back to Prince of Persia. And then you start to realize that over a span of years, it's amazing it took this long, things start to get pretty squirrely. You have an unpatched Windows PC out of the box. You plug it into the internet. You get it going, and you start downloading your updates. I hope they come quickly, because within 4 minutes, it will be compromised by a random worm knocking on the door saying, are you patched yet? Oh, you're not? Great. I will infect you. And at that point, your PC is possessed by a demon from somewhere else. Can you think of any other technology that is like this? My television doesn't work. Oh, were you watching Fox News last night? At 9:16, right when Ann Coulter, her head was spinning, that was the moment where you got the virus. It's like, no! No! It's like, oh, you put butter in your fridge. That's what poisoned your refrigerator. It won't work now. You'll have to send it back. It's like, no! But somehow, PCs, we accept. Or to use a very modern example, here's the happy puffer fish of Bitly. Why don't you take your perfectly functioning internet links and shorten them using Bitly? Because then, all these random links on the internet meant to last for the ages will all be piped through Libya, and Muammar Gaddafi gets to say if they keep working. This is a great idea. Like, what? Of course, this is how the internet should be working. It's very strange when things are down in this chaotic corner. Weird things happen, and sometimes it makes it insecure. It's best represented by this, the Cap'n Crunch bosun's whistle, prize in a box of cereal, Cap'n Crunch, in the late 1970s. And it turns out, after you've sugared up your kid, why not have her blow around the house with a whistle and make noise? Perfect partners. But if you covered up one hole of the whistle and then blew, it would generate a tone at 2600 hertz, which is exactly the tone used by AT&T, monopoly telephone provider, to indicate an idle network. Pick up the phone, dial a long-distance number, blow the whistle, free long-distance telephone calling. Boxes of cereal flying off the shelves. General Mills has no idea why. It's like, new third-party app for our cereal? Very strange. And it turns out that AT&T could fix this, because their network was meant to be in the upper right corner, not down here. It wasn't meant to be something that people could program with a whistle. So they changed it. They made it so that no sound you or a whistle could utter could instruct the network to give you free telephone calling. But the internet is still exactly at this point. The same conduit that carries our emails, our music, our video, are also the conduits that carry code designed to reprogram our machines. And that turns out to be the vector for all those viruses. So now we end up with a serious problem. The internet has moved over here. We love it. And it turns out to be genuinely dangerous to the things we care about. And that's a problem. Now, what else? Well, now the government comes to the rescue to the problem that's down in this corner. And the government is like, there is a big problem. I love this FBI warning. And this is like on the record. This is even on background. The FBI guy is like, computer attacks pose the biggest risk from a national security system other than a weapon of mass destruction or a bomb in one of our major cities. U.S. experts warn of Cybergeddon, in which an advanced economy where almost everything of importance is linked to computers falls prey to hackers with catastrophic results. All right, so the government is a tad worried about this. And they put out in 2003 a strategy to secure cyberspace, which spent most of its 150 pages saying, there is a huge problem here, digital Pearl Harbor, beware. And the end was like, I have no idea what to do about this. Because the network is basically in private hands. So like, well, let's have an information sharing and analysis center. We can talk about it. And like, here they are. We're at this center, and it's like, there's Steve Case or Jack Bauer or somebody. And it's like, the internet is down. What do we do? Let's tell people. We can't. The internet's down. Okay, then. We're done here. And what you actually see the government saying, they're trying to come up with, like, where do we send a detachment of Marines to protect the internet? And the experts are like, I don't know, Coast Guard? I got nothing. So here's like, a U.S. Senate bill will grant the president emergency powers to seize control of or shut down the internet. So it's like, send the Marines to an internet service provider, because clearly they're eating hamburgers instead of protecting the internet. The Marines will be like, protect the internet now! You ask people like, okay, we're on it. Like, we're doing what we can here. And in fact, even this was said to be a total exaggeration. The committees went on the record only on background, saying, no. The president has always had the power to shut down the internet since 1941. So really, there's nothing to see here, folks. It's like, yes, I sleep much better knowing that. And sure enough, you look at places like RAND or Sandia, and they do these reports on, you know, getting people worried. This is hypothetical, right? Which is why it's in 2011. New York area air traffic control systems are non-responsive. Hundreds of fatalities. Planes are going down everywhere because of some IT-based concern resulting from network traffic. Something on the internet made the planes go down. But because it's from the internet, we have no idea who was where because those original engineers didn't need to make money from it, so we don't know who was who. So we can't reverse bill the credit card of the subscriber that caused all this trouble with, you know, whatever the damages are from the planes. This is a huge problem, say the experts to the government, which is why the government is like, that's why we need to be able to trace attacks. To be able to trace attacks, we need to completely re-architect the internet. So for instance, the International Telecommunications Union, now they're like, let's have a new internet. The ITU was like, yes, we're going to have a focus group on next generation networks, also known as the Figginigan, and it's going to build a new network, and here it is! And of course, it's incredibly complicated and difficult to parse because it's a network that suddenly needs to know when not to listen to its users. I want to send a bit to you, but what if the bit doesn't want to be sent? And what if you're a bad guy? So you need all this junk in the middle. And once it gets implemented, over here is the internet, a little brown box, nothing to note. It'll connect to the internet, but this is supposed to be the new network. Now, to me, God help us if this is where we end up. You can think, I don't have to tell you about all the collateral effects that would come from a network that suddenly has a license plate on every packet, as if it's important to trace the way an automobile should be. So, do we have any other alternative? Well, here's the one that's actually been emerging. It's from our corporate quadrant. And the corporate quadrant basically said, you know what, you're right. It is not 1989, 1992, 94 anymore. Get rid of this architecture. And that's where Steve Jobs comes forward. And in version one of the iPhone, he's like, this thing is gorgeous. You're going to love it. And guess what? Everything we put on the phone for you. We control everything on the phone. Because otherwise, it's like a PC, which will stop working after 20 minutes. You have to keep rebooting it. That's not what you want in a phone. And you know what? He's right. So we end up with phones that can get controlled remotely and updated. So it's not just like the Brother smart word processor. It's actually updating, but only from Steve Jobs. And there are already a range of technologies at iPhone version 1 sentience. So, for example, some of you may have the OnStar system in your car. People have OnStar in their GM car. Have you seen this little button? And it gives you turn-by-turn directions, or here's what it looks like in the rearview mirror. And there's a little help button, and if you're in trouble, you press it, and you're like, help, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. And this woman, this is the actual woman, is like, don't worry, we know where you are. We're sending help. So the FBI realizes that this exists. And there's a car, a GM car, being driven by some people, served by an OnStar-like service, but not OnStar. And the FBI is like, you know, we want to know what's going inside that car. So they talk to the OnStar-like company. They're like, please send a software update that turns on the microphone in the rearview mirror at all times. The company does this and then has a litter of kittens and sues in the bravely titled case, The Company versus the United States of America. Because if you knew who they were, you wouldn't buy their cars. So the company sues saying we shouldn't have to do this. And that gets litigated. District court opinion is issued in the government's favor under seal. It then goes on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit reverses on the thinnest of reeds. The Ninth Circuit says that because the way it was implemented, even if the bad guys, the people of interest in the car, get into trouble and they ask for help, it will still only go to the FBI, which presumably would not come and help. So that's not fair. You have to make it so that when they ask for help, it three ways in the happy lady, and then it sends help, and then that's fine. That is the current state of law in the U.S. for covert surveillance using these tools. And we see the same thing with any smartphone. You could just send a firmware update to the phone, turn on the microphone. You don't have to be on a call. It's not to listen to your calls. It's to listen to you. And just turn it on and beam it up or save it so the next time you dock, it transfers the call over and then sends it over the internet to the government. Now, this is starting to sound like tinfoil hat territory, but it's exactly where we are at, amazingly, through our own choices in products. So you might say then, all right, what we have is a new path of infringing on individual liberties, sometimes encouraged by the government, but in any case mediated through the corporate space. How do we deal with that?
In this final section, Jonathan Zittrain tells about times in which the community of internet users, unofficial and unpaid, actually did rescue parts of the network from attacks.
I've already talked about how insecure the endpoints are, how much a PC can so quickly be pwned. It turns out the network is about equally insecure. The way that internet routing works with the laser pointer going all over the place, I said it was like crowd surfing, which is true, except when you're surfing a crowd, you can't be like, I'm going to Vernon, please. It's like, no, you kind of have to go wherever they send you. The internet needs to be able to send the packet in a certain direction, which means it needs to know where it's going. The framers didn't make a single map. Instead, they have each node occasionally look around and utter what it is near. So you look to your right and you tell the person on your left, this is what I see on my right. Lather, rinse, repeat. And the basic network knows where everything is. It's pretty astounding. It's called Border Gateway Protocol. But it relies on people being honest about what they see. So when the government of Pakistan wanted to filter out YouTube, they did it by just having the one ISP pretend to be YouTube. It just uttered, whoa, I'm YouTube. Who knew? And suddenly all its subscribers can't get there anymore because the packets are stopping at Pakistan Telecom. But that utterance got echoed around the internet. And within 2 minutes, YouTube was unavailable everywhere in the world because of this one fake utterance by one ISP. And there was nothing in particular that YouTube could do about it. That's a pretty big security hole. How did it get fixed within about 2 hours? It turns out there's a list, a mailing list of people called NANOG, the North American Network Operators Group, and they kind of sit around and talk about how to make a better network. It's a little weird, but that's what they do when they don't have a proportional font. So, all right, they're exchanging these emails. They're like, this is not a drill. YouTube has been hijacked. If you happen to be on this list and a mid-level employee at an ISP, here's how to manually reroute your routers to ignore this piece of poison. So it kind of got back up and running again. It's like if your house caught on fire. The bad news is you have no fire extinguisher and there is no fire department. That's bad news. The good news is people materialize out of nowhere with hoses, put out the fire, and leave. All right. Hey, on balance, that works. That's how the internet works. And I'm trying to think, like, how do we describe that phenomenon? And I'm like, I don't know. It's kind of like, it's feeling kind of fourth quadrant to me. Because there's a community of people who band together just because they like it to make it better. And nobody pays them to do it or even knows who they are. This is what is making the internet function. It's true of Wikipedia, too. I mean, think about Wikipedia, this crazy idea of starting with 20 articles and anybody can edit it and eventually we'll have a great encyclopedia for the world. Stupidest idea ever. Now, so ubiquitous that you can find it on Chinese restaurant menus. I don't know about you, but I prefer my Wikipedia with pimentos. I have a theory on this, but I'll share it later if we have time. I know we're short on time. Am I okay if I go another 10 minutes? Is that fair?
Sure.
Yeah, we're having a good time? Okay. So how does Wikipedia prevent every page from being turned into an ad for a Rolex watch, right? Because email didn't dodge that bullet. What's keeping Wikipedia from it? Well, it's this, the administrator's notice board, itself an editable page. Not edible, but editable. Very important difference for those taking notes. An editable page where people just present their problems one at a time. You know, it's like tendentious editing by user Andy V. Phil. Apologies if you're here, Andy. A non-attacking me for reverting. This is my favorite. A long story. And it turns out that there are more people accessing this page to solve the problems presented there than there are problems appearing on the page. That's the secret to Wikipedia. A bunch of people working in windowless rooms just because. Now, it does make you wonder if there is ever like an extremely popular Star Trek convention, who will mind the store? This could be a serious security threat. They should just shut it down for the day if that's going to happen. But in the meantime, they gather together things in like the counter-vandalism unit, modeled after 24, except the icon is an anime figure mopping the floor, and it's like nobody appointed them. They just do it. Because they like to, and they don't even arrange shifts. It's just they happen to be from around the world. So just as soon as somebody is going to bed at about 4 a.m., there's somebody else just getting up around 9 p.m. looking to help in keeping the wiki clean. And this turns out not just to be an interesting example unto itself, but it actually has a huge impact on what we normally think of as the turf of the First Amendment. Here's a book called The Cartoons That Shook the World. About the cartoons of Muhammad published by the newspaper. You end up with here, this was Yale University Press, and they were going to put the cartoons in the book because it's a book about the cartoons. And they're going to have a bunch of other depictions of Muhammad through the ages so that the author can make the point that this is a relatively new worry in the Islamic world about depictions of Muhammad. The university puts it out to national security experts, and they decide not to allow the cartoons in the book about the deletion of the cartoons. And in fact, they say they were designed to pick a fight. And by the way, you can get them elsewhere. You can see them right now on Wikipedia. So part of their reason as a university not to go there was Wikipedia was already there. Thanks, Wikipedia, you've got our back. And oddly enough, Wikipedia does. Wikipedia has an amazingly comprehensive article about the controversy, including the cartoons. And like, there's no Wikipedia to burn down. It's like, where do you go? And if Jimbo, the founder, were afraid, it's not clear he could do anything about it. He could be like, yeah, no, guys, really, let's get rid of this article. They're like, no, sorry, it's staying. It's an amazing bulwark down here in the fourth quadrant where Wikipedia, to be an editor, is the same as to be a user. There really isn't this distinction that we observe in the upper two quadrants of a difference between the people who run it and the people who use it. And that turns out to be an incredibly important bulwark for freedom in the classic First Amendment context.
We've been listening to law professor Jonathan Zittrain speaking on the serious structural problems of the Internet and the civil liberties implications of the proposed solutions. To Zittrain, the problems are real and pressing, but giving the government more control is not the answer, nor is giving the corporations more control. Either move is likely to seriously damage what few civil liberties Americans have left. A better solution is to give more control to communities of users. Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. For more information on the show, check out our website at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Incidentally, one of the sites that Zittrain noted, Cats That Look Like Hitler, is still online after lo these many years. Check out www.catsthatlooklikehitler.com. Here, get to my non-carborundum. Keep the faith, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.